welcome to the Messiah's Branch Broadcast, a program dedicated to biblical truth and prophecy featuring Pastor Dan of the Messiah's Branch Ministry. And now, here's Pastor Dan.
Welcome to Mission Watch, another Messiah's Branch satellite radio program. We're broadcasting from the Flint Hills of Kansas, and we're on the American Voice Radio Network. The broadcast date for this program is September 2nd, 2012. Saints, the world is in turmoil. Most just don't realize it, but we are in that time of the end. And that's the time before Messiah's glorious return. So it's time to get out of sin, the world, and look to the holy city. Look to the one who suffered and died for you. Please make this a choice in your life tonight. That means making the choice to make in Yeshua HaMashiach, or Jesus Christ, if you will, your personal Savior. Having a personal relationship, it takes much more than just saying, okay, He's in my heart and I'm saved. You need to have a personal relationship. If you don't know what that is, you can call me and we'll talk about it. If you need help with anything after the program, call us. If you get the machine, please leave your name, your prayer request, and message. Your name, your number, your prayer request or message. Make sure you leave your phone number. And I would ask that you would please leave your number slowly. The slower that you leave it, the easier it is for an old brain like mine to be able to decipher it. And in an emergency, you may even call my cell number, which is 316-619-4886. I give that to you to prove to you that I am serious about helping you. And what is a minister if he can't minister? What is a minister if he won't answer somebody's prayers and help them? Anyway, always be a blessing to others. You can always find updates with the breaking news, our ministry radio program archives, and our mailing address at our blog, which is simply prophecyhour.com. That's prophecyhour.com. Also, remember, don't forget, I will pray for you or with you, so call. Now prayer, and we'll bring on tonight's guest. In fact, he's one of my favorite guests. He's one of my favorite people. Dear Heavenly Father, in Yeshua HaMashiach's name I pray. Father, I pray that radio goes tonight according to your will and not necessarily my guest, what he wants or what I want, but what you want. And please give all out their ears in which to hear the truth. Amen and amen. Well, just what's going on with our government. Uma Abedin, and I probably mispronounced that, meets all the criteria to be a spy, but yet she is almost hailed as some sort of female hero. Really? What is wrong with John McCain and others? Are they just blind? On this program, we talked with three different people about her. Janice Kephart, a border security specialist that made a report to the 9/11 commission about the hijackers' immigration status. Believe it, they had immigration status. Wow, she was a good guest. She was on a couple of times. We also had a man on that works with Walid Shubat, and I'm going to ask our guest who that was in a minute because his name slips my mind. But our guest is Ben Barak, who is back with us tonight. He is the author of the new book, Unsung Davids, a radio talk show host. He is currently working with ex-terrorist Walid Shubat. Boy, how would you like to work with an ex-terrorist? Anyway, that's not as foreboding as it sounds, because Walid Shubat is a saved man, and he is the topic of one of the chapters in Ben's book called Unsung Davids. It's a book about heroes in our time, and what do we need now? And we do need heroes and people to look up to. Anyway, it's a great book. You can get it at Amazon. You can find it at Ben's website. We'll talk about that later. But let's get him on here. And so, Ben, are you ready to talk about something important?
Always, Pastor Dave.
Always. That's the tagline from your radio program, isn't it?
Yes. Let's talk about something important. For crying out loud. I should probably add that at the end.
Yeah, for crying out loud. Well, you know, I love you. You're like I said, you are one of my favorite people to talk to.
Back at you.
And I appreciate you. Anyway, well, all that talk about your radio program and you didn't even bother to tell them what the website was?
Yeah, benbarrick.com.
BenBarrick.com. You know, that's not Barack, you know, like Barack, you know, or Barack Hussein Obama, you know.
Pastor, I have a separate tagline that's specifically devoted to that, and that is, remember, it's Barrick, it's not Barack.
Okay, Mr. Barrick. You know, that's like barracks in the barracks that you go and sleep in.
Correct. Singular.
Anyway, let's go back to Walt Shoebat for a minute. It slipped my mind. What's that fellow that works with him?
I don't know. Oh, Keith.
Keith Davies.
Keith Davies. Uh-huh.
Keith Davies was the other one that talked with me on this subject that we're going to talk about again tonight.
Right.
And so you're kind of an unsung David. Why don't you take us back to what we talked about in 2011, and then so the people know what we're up to.
Yeah, back last year when Wienergate broke with Anthony Weiner, the congressman, and he inadvertently tweeted photos of himself that were somewhat unflattering and intended to be private. I guess tweeted them to his entire list of Twitter followers inadvertently, and it became a big scandal. Breitbart broke it, and it became a big scandal. Well, in the days that after that, I was looking up stories on this a little bit, and I noticed that Huma Abedin, who I had heard her name before, but I didn't really pay much attention to. So I was doing a little bit of reading, and I came across a bio of her, and what piqued my interest was I saw that she was born in Kalamazoo, Michigan, at a very early age moved to Saudi Arabia with her family.
Stop for a second.
Yeah.
Huma is his
Anthony
wife.
Weiner's wife, yes.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry, I forgot to mention that.
That's all right.
Yeah, so,
go on.
So I said, well, wait a minute, Saudi Arabia, and she didn't come back to the United States until she went to college, which she went to George Washington University. And so in my mind, knowing, and you know this too, red flags when you're talking about Islam, you know, if you're talking about a westernized person in Islam, you're probably not dealing with a big deal. You know, somebody that's just kind of raised in the Western culture and is not all that religious. But I noticed that she was, A, a devout Muslim, and B, that she had spent nearly her entire young life in Saudi Arabia. So I pick up the phone and I call Waleed, and I tell him this, and he says, okay, let me look into it. And so he looks into it, and he finds that in Arabic, he finds that Huma's mother, Saleha Abedin, is a leader within the Muslim Sisterhood, which is a group of 63 people that are leading the female equivalent of the Muslim Brotherhood, and it was a very very connected group. I mean, this is not a group of people that are just of women and some male leaders within it that are like guidance I don't know what you call them, but they're like on the guidance council.
It's not
so much the, and they're part of the Brotherhood. I mean, they're literally part of the Brotherhood. And as we uncovered this, we learned that Huma's brother is also very connected to the Brotherhood. His name is Hassan Abedin, and we learned at the time that he served at the Oxford Center for Islamic Studies in Great Britain, and that he served on a board with Abdullah Omar Nassif. Abdullah Omar Nassif is the guy that founded a group called the Rabita Trust. He was also the Secretary General for the Muslim World League, and both of those groups have financed Al-Qaeda. So here we have Huma's mother, Huma's brother, and her father, who also died in 1993, but also worked with Nassif before his death. So we've got all these Huma Abedin family members connected to basically an Al-Qaeda financier. And Huma Abedin, in 1996, when she returned from Saudi Arabia, she attended George Washington University, and then she took a job with Hillary Clinton in 1996 as an aide. She is still with Hillary Clinton here in 2012. In 1996, She started as an aide. She worked on the Hillary Clinton for Senate campaign in 2000. And then she became her deputy chief of staff and closest advisor in 2009 when Hillary took the job as Secretary of State. Now, all of that to say, well, this doesn't necessarily implicate Puma, does it? Well, it kind of does, because you look at a group called the Institute of Muslim Minority Affairs. It's called IMMA, I-M-M-A. This group is the one thing on the Internet, the one thing that we were able to find that opens, it's like a gateway for the background of Huma Abedin, because there is very little on her. In fact, when Waleed was doing a search for her in Arabic, there was virtually nothing. I mean, and maybe even literally nothing on her.
But okay, let me break in for a second.
Sure.
Now, just from what you said so far, let's do this for the folks. Okay, Hillary Clinton is the State Department, right?
Right. Correct.
Okay, now that's a pretty top security job, wouldn't you say?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, wouldn't you think it? I'm sorry, I can hardly keep a straight face, but how does this person get a security clearance to even be with her? That doesn't make sense.
Those are the questions that Representative Michelle Bachmann, Representative Louis Gohmert in Texas, Representative Trent Franks in Arizona, Representative Lynn Westmoreland in Georgia, and Representative Tom Rooney in Florida asked. Those are the questions, those are the types of questions that they asked in a letter that was sent to various inspectors general back in June 13th. They sent a letter to the State Department's Inspector General and CC'd Hillary. They sent a letter to the DHS Inspector General, the DOJ Inspector General, the Department of National Intelligence Inspector General, and the Department of Defense Inspectors General. And they all had, each letter had different concerns about Muslim Brotherhood infiltration.
Okay. We're going to stop right there, because we're going to go back into that. Now, go back into this Internet thing. That was just a small part from that. You need to tell them about the Internet thing where you found all about her at.
Right. The IMMA is an organization that was founded in the late 70s by Abdullah Omar Nassif, the Al-Qaeda financier. And this is what we learned in the last week or two. Waleed was able to cover the Saudi royal family's manifesto.
Really?
Yes. And what this is this IMMA and other groups like the Muslim World League and the International Institute of the International Islamic Relief Organization and other organizations. These are formed at the behest of the Saudi royal family. We really have something here, because the Saudi royal family is ever increasingly being implicated in 9/11. But let me back up to the IMMA. The IMMA was founded in the late 70s by Huma's father, or by Nassif. And Nassif, through a middleman, appointed Huma's father and her mother to head this organization. And the IMMA's purpose, as outlined in the Saudi manifesto itself, is to, through education, print journals, print literature, to spread Islam across the globe, and to turn Muslim minority lands into Muslim majority lands. That includes the United States, because once you can turn the Muslim majority countries to 50% plus,
right,
of Muslim, then you've got Sharia. And that's what the goal of this is. It sounds nice, the Institute of Muslim Minority Affairs. Well, no, but it's not. That's not what it's meant to do.
Right.
And this is a smoking gun here. The Saudi royal family is behind this. And Abdullah Omar Nassif has got his hand in the cookie jar. But what's interesting, too, about the IMMA is that Huma herself served on the board of the IMMA from at least 1996 until 2008, late 2008, at which point she took the job with Hillary. So here you are, Hillary Clinton, chief of Secretary of State, and you tap this girl that has been your aide for 12 years, and you know that she's been working at the IMMA, a group that seeks the overthrow of the United States government through education and Islamic outreach, and you say, hey, come work with me as my closest advisor. How in the world?
Yeah, let's say something. I'm going to say something. Okay, it's like this, folks. You know, the State Department. Okay, well, we decided that that's a top secret place. Okay, surely, either Hillary Clinton is so dumb she did no kind of a record check on her, and our capacity to check records is completely gone, or she knows all about it. And if she knows all about it and knows who she is, the reason is, why would she?
Well, if one thing we can say about the Clintons is that they're not dumb.
Clintons,
you may call them diabolical, you may call them wicked, you may call them evil, but calling them dumb would be a misnomer, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. They're all of those except for dumb. They have their hands in the cookie jar. I don't think we've heard anything out of the last of the Clintons. I think they've got some diabolical plan, really, right now as it speaks. What it is, I don't know. But I just don't trust them. Do you?
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, you mentioned Waleed as a subject in my book. The other chapter, the very first chapter, is about a guy that got royally screwed over by the Clintons, Peter Paul.
Mm-hmm.
He was no saint. But what they did to him will speak volumes about what the Clintons are all about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you want to learn about how where we get this about the Clintons, this is one of the ways to do it. You pick up this book and read that chapter, and if you don't know about the Clintons, I'm telling you, you will be amazed, and you'll get maybe to where we're at with this, that there's just something really sinister really behind all this, don't you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Absolutely. So, okay, now I think we can click over safely. So now, first off, McCain. You know, I have to say the same thing about McCain. You know, McCain is a war hero, and I can think he was, I don't know, maybe he just looked at, what do you think? He just looked at her and working around Hillary and said, oh, she's a nice girl, or... You know, what do you think happened with him? I don't get it.
I think that the Muslim Students Association, which is a Muslim Brotherhood front group, think about what they do. Think about what their objectives are. And they started in the 1960s. What they do is they recruit college Muslim students, and they teach them to how to work their way through the political structure of a system. And we don't, you know, as Americans, we go to college to get a degree and get a job and go provide for the family and whatnot.
Right.
Well, that's all been going on for decades. The Muslim Students Association has been teaching Muslim students how to acquire power in the halls of U.S. government. So you have aides, you have advisors, you have Muslim Brotherhood-connected individuals inside the U.S. government that are now ascending to power. Now they have, I don't know this to be true, but it wouldn't surprise me if there are Muslim advisors in John McCain's office, Muslim assistants and aides and whatnot. And these kinds of things, and I do have someone that gave me a first-hand account just in general about what goes on in D.C. You get these young, attractive Muslim women that go into these offices and work with these politicians, and you know, whenever there's an anti-Islamic sentiment that's out there in the news, they go to their congressman or their superior and say, no, that's not the real Islam, and they bat their eyes and all this. I mean, I heard that firsthand from somebody that's been there and seen this stuff. So I think there's some of that going on. The other thing that's going on is, look, John McCain became a senator, I believe, first in 1986, and I think he was a congressman before that.
Mm-hmm.
He has presided over a long period of time where we have watched Muslim Brotherhood gain a foothold in this country. This happened on his watch. This happened on the watch of John Boehner. This happened on the watch of all of these establishment Republicans. They step back. If they're honest with themselves, they have to say, wait a minute, I've allowed this to happen. I mean, maybe not solely, but I've allowed this to happen because it was on my watch.
Right.
And whether they don't want to face it, whether they don't want to admit it, I don't know. But I will say that, during the Clinton administration, in particular, there was a massive influx of Muslim Brotherhood-connected individuals. Think of Abdurrahman Alamoudi, who actually worked for the State Department himself
right.
in 1998. He has already been convicted of terrorism charges, and he's serving a 23-year prison sentence. How did he get a clearance? You got Sami Al-Aryan, the guy that Bill O'Reilly outed back in 2001, 2002, which he hasn't done any of that since, and that raises a
right.
whole other set of flags. But Sami Al-Aryan, I mean, he had access to the halls of power. And so I think when you look at this over a long period of time, you see where these establishment politicians, maybe they're in denial, maybe they don't. You know, it's like I make this analogy, the Penn State scandal. You know, you had that Mike McQuarrie walk in on that Jerry Sandusky,
right.
that young boy in the shower,
right.
And they covered it up. At some point, when you cover that up, you have implicated yourself, and then you have to be part of the cover-up. The Joe Paternos have to be part of the cover-up. The presidents have to be part of the cover-up because they covered up a blatantly obvious crime. So that implicates them. So now do we have something like that? Do we have something like, after 9/11, should George Bush have gone after the Saudi royal family instead of the Taliban? Or in addition to the Taliban, should he have gone after the Saudi royal family, Abdullah Omar Nassif, instead of Iraq? I mean, Waleed and I are working on a report right now, and it's kind of fresh in my mind, so that's why I'm going.
Go right ahead, go.
But the when you look at the 9/11 Commission report, what it is lacking is phenomenal, because it avoids talking about al-Qaeda financiers. And all of the al-Qaeda financiers, the Muslim World League, Abdullah Omar Nassif as the head of the Rabita Trust, the International Islamic Relief Organization, the SAR, S-A-A-R, and there are others, all of them, Muslim Youth, World Association of Muslim Youth, these organizations are not mentioned in the 9/11 Commission Report, and these are the sources of the funding for al-Qaeda that attacked us. The question then becomes is why? And where we're at this point is that after 9/11, it appears that this administration, the George Bush administration, decided at some point, they appeared to start going down the right path. After about a month after 9/11, the Rabita Trust, founded by Abdullah Omar Nassif, mm-hmm. and run by a founder of al-Qaeda, was shut down for financing al-Qaeda. But there's nothing that really ever happened after that. Rabita Trust is not mentioned one time in the 9/11 Commission report. Why? Why isn't it? And because the Bush administration shut it down for financing al-Qaeda. How could, I mean, it's a 500-plus page report. How could that not be in, at least once in the Commission report? So what we're quickly coming to the conclusion of, and we still have work to do on this, is the Bush administration after 9/11 started going down the right road, and then at some point, and we're looking at 2002, 2003, went in a completely, potentially fatally incorrect position, direction, because they decided to go after Iraq. And they, which basically they allied with the Saudi royal family in doing that.
Right, absolutely.
Instead of going after, you know, think of it. Back in after 9/11, George W. Bush had a 90% approval rating.
Right.
He could have done whatever he wanted.
Whatever he wanted, yeah.
Yeah, and so think about what he could have done. And I have reason to believe. I've read a piece by William Murray of the Christian.
Yeah, William Murray. I've had him on radio before, and his mom is responsible for the prayers being taken out of school.
That's right. He wrote a piece. He wrote a diary that's still available online of his days after 9/11, because he had access to the congressmen and senators
right.
and the White House and all that. And he wrote it out, and I could not believe what I was reading. He knew the truth in the days after 9/11. So to call this Monday morning quarterbacking is incorrect. George W. Bush administration knew the truth about who was behind 9/11.
Well, listen, isn't there some oil ties or something with the Bush family and the Saudis, I thought?
Yeah, there's a book written. I think his name is Craig Unger wrote a book about that. I didn't read it. But, I mean, when you think about the oil ties, you know, maybe we were too reliant on Saudi oil, and we still are and all that. But imagine if a president, after 9/11, attack like that, has 90% approval rating, calling in all of his cabinet members, calling in his Secretary of Energy, and just laying it out, look, I've got political capital like nobody's ever seen. I want energy independence within 2 years.
Yeah,
I want
absolutely.
Pollution restrictions. I want refineries built. I want oil drilling taking place. And in those 2 years, we could maybe be in Afghanistan, taking care of the Taliban, letting everybody
know
that that's where we are. That's what we're doing.
Absolutely.
And while we get energy independent in 2003, 2004, once that day comes, we go to the Saudi royal family and say, now we got you.
Right.
But we didn't do that.
Okay.
And it might be fatal.
We're getting ready to do a break. Wow, some important information. We're going to get back with it, folks, right after this break. But I want you to know where to get this book. It's called Unsung Davids by Ben Barak. 10 Men Who Battled Goliath Without Glory. This is a fantastic book, and there's a chapter in there about Hillary, Waleed Shubat, who we were talking about, and some many more other things, and a really touching chapter about a fellow that stood up against Jim Jones. And so anyway, folks, we'll be back in 1 minute. What's that website?
BenBarak.com.
BenBarak.com, and we'll be back in about 3 minutes.
Can your family survive a food shortage lasting 2 weeks, 6 months, or maybe longer? Sound far-fetched? We live in precarious times. There is an ever-increasing possibility of food shortages caused by terrorist attacks, natural disasters, truck strikes, or monetary collapse. You owe it to yourself and family to prepare, and you can by getting a supply of our long-storing, freeze-dried, and dehydrated foods. Our foods are time-tested to store for decades, require a minimum of time and energy to prepare, while maintaining superior nutritional value, freshness, and taste. Our foods were designed for the space program and are in constant use today by our own nuclear submarine service. Contact the Freeze Dry Guy today at freezedryguy@landsat.com. That's freezedryguy@landsat.com or call 530-265-8333. 530-265-8333 and let them know you heard it on American Voice Radio.
Prices going up, homes being foreclosed, unemployment insurance running out, jobs leaving the country. Many people cannot afford to eat or keep a roof over their head. Too many can do neither. Messiah's Branch has a mission church in Wichita, Kansas that helps the victims of this banker's economy, the American people. Your neighbors, the mission is the last hope for so many Americans. We need your help to lift up the poorest of the poor. These are men, women, and children who once had homes, now in the street. They all need what you need. First aid, beds, food, clothing, and so on. You can send a monetary gift or a box of necessities to 230 West 4th Street, Florence, Kansas, 66851. Or donate online by going to WichitaHomeless.com or simply call 316-619-4886. 316-619-4886.
This is Pastor Dan Catlin, and you're listening to Mission Watch on the American Voice Radio Network. please remember to pray tonight about a donation for our work with the homeless and poor from our mission church in Wichita, Kansas. And of course, boy, I'm tongue-tied tonight. Of course, folks, the mission church takes care of the poor, meaning the homeless are poor. And anyway, let's just go on. Anyway, help us care for the people that the Father sent us. We get no help from any organized churches or government agencies. It's only folks like you that have supported us for 12 years and made this mission church work. Can you help me with my prescription? You got any cold meds? Do you have some painkillers? Pastor, can you look at my shoes? My girls need some clothes for school. Pastor, can you pray for me? Do you have a Bible for me? Why will the churches not help? Have you got a blanket? These are words that I hear all the time, most every day. And we don't always have everything to fulfill those needs. But the people understand it because they realize we do what we can and we do it from our hearts. As we minister to the poorest of the poor, they cannot support us. I'm praying for a miracle to go into September ready with the mission bills paid and the church stocked up. So stand with me that we raise around $3,000, like right now, as soon as possible. If each one that hears this donates something, we would more than hit the mark. While any size donation will help tonight, pray about a sacrificial donation. Help us get off the edge of the cliff. And we're the very last hope for so many people. And remember, we help the homeless and the poor, meaning the poor people that have roofs over their head, but they can't afford everything like clothing and food, but they are keeping a roof. So we help the homeless and poor. Anyway, donate what you can. Remember, we are responsible to care for one another, as we really are brothers keepers. And the kind of gifts that we want are the ones that come from the heart, because that's the ones that the Father notices. You can donate online by mailing a check or money order. You can find this information at prophecyhour.com, or you can simply call me at 620-878-4682. 620-878-4682. And now we're back with the author of the book, Unsung Davids, Ben Barak. Are you there with us, Ben?
I'm here.
Did I say the name right?
Yes.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay. Anyway, Ben, where can I get this book out again?
Well, you can get it at benbarak.com, B-E-N-B-A-R-R-A-C-K.com.
Okay, that's where we want him to go. Okay, well, take us back into the second half, and let's see where you're going to go.
Yeah. One thing I forgot to mention was that we uncovered that in addition to serving on the board of the IMMA, Huma Abedin, who also served on the board with Abdullah Omar Nassif. So Abdullah Omar Nassif, Al-Qaeda financier, was her boss for at least 3 years until his name came off the masthead on the website. But what else we discovered was that when Huma Abedin was returned to the United States in approximately 1996, she then joined the Muslim Students Association at George Washington University and was on the board. She was on the board of about 8 members with her in 1997. She came off that board sometime prior to 1999. But what's interesting is that the Muslim Students Association has hundreds of chapters across the country. It was founded by the Muslim Brotherhood in North America in the 60s. It is a Muslim Brotherhood group, period. Plain and simple, it is a group that seeks the overthrow of the United States government from within. There is no disputing this. This is not refutable. This is fact. This was uncovered in the Holy Land Foundation trial in a document that was presented in that trial, penned in 1991 by a guy named Muhammad Akram of the Muslim Brotherhood. This document was approved by the Shura Council of the Muslim Brotherhood that said that very thing. The goal of the Muslim Brotherhood in America is to overthrow the government of the United States and implement Islam. Okay, so with that as a premise, Huma Abedin, Hillary Clinton's Deputy Chief of Staff, closest advisor, was on the board of MSA in George Washington University in 1997. Now, somebody might say, well, the MSA has hundreds of chapters. Maybe she didn't know. Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. So, okay, but
hey, I got a bridge, I'll show you.
That's right. Well, what we learned after that, as if that wasn't enough, In 2001, late 2001, none other than Anwar al-Awlaki, the guy that inspired the Fort Hood shooter, jihadist, Nidal Malakassam.
Yeah.
Anwar al-Awlaki joined the George Washington University Muslim Students Association in late 2001, about 4 years after Huma left.
Mm-hmm.
So he was serving on that board, if you can believe it, as a chaplain. And next to him, he served on that board from late 2001 to, I want to say, about April of 2002. So he wasn't on there long, but who cares? He was serving next to a guy named Mohammed Omeish. Mohammed Omeish and Anwar al-Awlaki at that time were the only two Muslim chaplains on the MSA board at George Washington University. Mohammed S. Omeish is, at the time, in 2000, around the time of 9/11, was, get ready for this, was the president of the Islamic, the International Islamic Relief Organization of the United States. This same IIRO is the same group that rolls up under the Muslim Brotherhood, and none other than Abdullah Omar Nassif was the Secretary General of the Muslim World League. So the Muslim World League is over the IIRO. The IIRO was in America, was led by Mohammed Omeish, who served on the board at MSA with Anwar al-Awlaki, the same MSA chartered George Washington University at which Huma Abedin served. This is where we are. Now, Mohammed Omeish has a brother, Assam Omeish, who had a government position in Virginia and was released, was forced to resign when a Democratic governor, Tim Kaine at the time, learned that there was video of him praising Hamas and Hezbollah outside the White House at Lafayette Park on video. Assam Omeish also hired Anwar al-Awlaki to work for him at his organization in Washington, D.C. So you got both Omeish brothers connected to Anwar al-Awlaki. This is so surreal. It defies any reality.
Hold 1 minute, folks. Listen, if this happened back in the 60s, that if this woman had, let's say that she got the job and then it discovered this, she would be arrested for being a spy.
That's correct.
These entities are all people that have pledged some sort of violence in some sort of manner against overthrowing the United States of America. What are they doing in power? There's something going on here. You can't tell me, Ben, that the people in power, so to speak, don't know. I mean, so what is going on?
Yeah, you can't say that they don't know. At some point you have to speculate.
absolutely.
We have all these facts. We have these facts. I look back at a guy named in World War II, a guy named Philippe Pétain.
Mm-hmm.
Philippe Pétain was a French general in World War I. He was a World War I war hero. He went into retirement basically in the 30s, and when France was invaded by the Germans, they were in dire straits, and they were like, what can we do? And they were grasping at straws, and well, how can we fight these Nazis? And so they come up with this idea to bring Philippe Pétain out of retirement. And one of the reasons he was so successful in World War I was that he had time to war plan. He had time to strategize. He had time. He had money. He had resources, all that. And he had time. Well, now here he is. Okay, the Nazis are taking over. Here you go, Felipe. You're in your 80s. Go ahead and deal with these people. So Felipe Pétain ended up succumbing to the Nazis, and he did so in a way where he was able to, he thought, save face. He was given control of Vichy, France, and okay, the Germans come into your country and they take 2/3 of it and they say, here, we're going to put you in charge of the other third.
Right.
And have at it. There's your reward. Oh, it's great. This is what Philippe Pétain did. Well, ultimately, he was doing the devil's bidding, because he was under the Philippe Pétain regime in Vichy, France, he was sending Jews to the Nazis.
Right.
I mean, this is how bad it got. And, you know, it's because he feared man is basically what happened to Philippe Pétain. And when the war ended, he was found guilty of treason. He was sentenced to death. And he that sentence was commuted by Charles de Gaulle because he was old and he was in prison, so he let it go. But all that to say, we might be witnessing a similar dynamic of denial and of maybe even intimidation on the part of our leaders. You had Michael Bloomberg up at the Ground Zero Mosque, supporting that. You have John McCain supporting Huma Abedin, John Boehner supporting Huma Abedin, despite all these mountains of evidence that this is the common argument.
Well, let's roll this out in something. Part of this maybe it is speculation, but number one, do you remember back when Mr. Abomination was elected to office? He made a statement and said that we were no longer a Christian nation, but actually alluded to the fact that he says that we are a Muslim nation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how does he make that jump? And this is a good time to bring it in. Why don't you bring in that about the Democratic National Committee?
Yeah. The it's called the Juma Prayer. And if you don't think that the Democratic Party has completely been co-opted by forces of evil at this point, I don't think you're paying attention. We've got people that are lifelong Democrats that maybe still have blinders on and aren't paying attention to this. But the Democratic Party has been taken over. It's been taken over by socialists, by communists, by Marxists, by Islamists, by anarchists, by whatever you want to find that's not good, and they haven't. And this Friday, what month are we in? August 31st.
Well, this will be September.
Okay, so this will already be over. But the Democratic National Convention is going to be home to the Juma prayer, Islamic prayer, and 20,000, and that number may be inflated, it may be accurate, it may be underestimated, who knows, but the intent is to bring as many Muslims to the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, as possible on their day of prayer to pray the Juma prayer. Now, there are several things disconcerting about this, but one of them is the fact that the guy that's at the head of this thing, and it's interesting because we talked about the INMA.
Right.
The group that is leading this is the Bureau of Indigenous Muslim Affairs.
Wow.
BIMA.
BIMA.
So, Institute of Muslim Minority Affairs is about educating people internationally and getting people to turn Muslim minority nations into Muslim majority nations with literature and journals and all this. And they target countries that have Muslim minorities to turn them, to flip them.
Right.
Well, now you've got the Bureau, and Institute. Bureau is something that is more government-oriented, and go figure, it's a Democratic National Convention, of indigenous Muslim affairs. Indigenous means these are Muslims that are born here, that are American citizens. Hey, we have a vote. You're going to have to listen to us. The BIMA versus the IMA, and that's, I found that very interesting. But the guy that's heading the BIMA effort at the DNC is a guy named Siraj Wahaj. Siraj Wahaj has to say his past is checkered would be an insult to checkers. he is a guy who is tied to the blind sheikh, Omar Abdul Rahman, the guy from the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. Mary Jo White, a U.S. attorney that prosecuted a lot of these things in New York, identified Siraj Wahaj as an unindicted co-conspirator in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. He's tied to the Islamic Society of North America, which is Muslim Brotherhood. He's tied to the Muslim American Society, which was founded by Muslim Brotherhood. He is on the advisory council of the Council on American Islamic Relations, Muslim Brotherhood front group. He is steeped in Muslim Brotherhood connections. And in fact, he is on record in a speech he gave in 1992 as saying that he wants to replace the U.S. Constitution with an Islamic caliphate. This is the guy leading the effort of the Democrats, the Muslims at the Democratic Convention. This is the guy who is leading the Muslims at the convention. We are beyond asleep, this country, if we do not wake up to this kind of stuff.
Okay, come on. Now, stop a second. Okay, this kind of a man speak at the Democratic National Convention. This is also somebody that should be in prison anyway from the speech that he has.
Right.
Not speaking and praying to bring in the Democratic National Convention. Now, listen, I know maybe some of you folks out there, I'm sure not everybody listening to my radio program are Republican or Independents. I know there's some Democrats probably out there, too. You need to wake up and save your party. You need to wake up and save America because, you know, just because they say they are who they say they are, that doesn't mean that. You know, you need to wake up. You need to pray for your party, but you need to get outspoken. Where's this headed to? I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't either. In fact, Siraj Wahaj, just while you were talking, I remembered this. Back in 2009, 1 week after the Fort Hood shooting, he was invited to a roundtable discussion with Mayor Michael Bloomberg in New York City. And the two men shook hands. And how in the world this man was allowed into a roundtable discussion at City Hall with Mayor Michael Bloomberg is also beyond me. But again, we need to remember that over the last several decades, the Muslim community in the United States they have been effective. There's no doubt about it. They've been effective. They have established Muslim Students Associations all across the country in universities at which they actively recruit people and entice them with power by training them how to move up through government. In fact, at the Juma prayer actually has a promotional video that they released back in June. And one of the guys in the video is a guy named James Yee. James Yee is an interesting figure because at one point he was arrested for espionage by the United States government. He was released or not convicted or whatever. He was approved to be a chaplain and a Muslim chaplain in the U.S. military. He came out of Abdurrahman Alamoudi's group. Abdurrahman Alamoudi, who I mentioned earlier, is the guy who was arrested in 2003, worked for the State Department in 1998, and was convicted in 2004 and sentenced to 23 years in prison for charges related to terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
James Yee came out of his group. James Yee is in the promotional video for this Juma prayer, and behind him you will see a banner that shows various Muslim Brotherhood group logos. And so this guy, James Yee, is up there. He's talking about, and he quoted Keith Ellison, the first Muslim elected to U.S. Congress. I found this interesting because if Keith Ellison had the interest of America at heart, why would he have Muslim Brotherhood people quoting him? James Yee says, well, as Keith Ellison said, if you don't have a seat at the table, then you're on the menu.
Really?
This is the mindset of the Muslim community that comes out of the Muslim Students Association and the Muslim Brotherhood. They have believed, and it's uncanny how this lines up with Bill Ayers and the Weather Underground and their goals. Their goals were they realized they couldn't get any inroads by setting bombs and fighting and violence and all that, so they decided to get into the power centers. And that's what these people are doing. And the mask is off, Pastor Dan and your listeners. The mask is off. They're not pretending anymore. When they're doing things like this, putting Siraj Wahaj at the head of the Democratic National Convention Juma prayer, for crying out loud.
Well, you know, it just begs, it really baffles me. I've gave this a lot of thought inside and out, and especially when I've had people like IQR Rizzoli on here, and we've talked about the real nature of Islam and everything, and talked to Walid, countless people. And it goes back to one thing. These people that are helping them, the left, let's just call it that, the left that are helping them or bowing to them or allowing them to get infiltrate like this, they would not want to, what are they, just nuts? I mean, they would not want to live under Sharia law. So what are they doing? What?
Well, I get back to what we talked about earlier. We had George Bush had 90% approval after 9/11. Who made up that 90%? Who were they? And because now, since then, you have, we're completely divided. We were not led properly. And that includes look.
Right.
There's a significant percentage of the 90% that supported George Bush after 9/11 that decided to go the direction you're talking about, to side with the Democratic Party. That is the fault of people that were leading us, and that were not leading us properly.
Absolutely.
Because we were misguided. And I would like to say right now, because at the time I supported going into Iraq.
Okay.
I supported what we did. I was behind George Bush, and when people got, in 2003, 2004, when people got on my case, I'd give them an argument with them. Let me just say, I'm sorry. You were right, okay? Come back.
come back.
Because I was wrong. We were wrong. Karl Rove was wrong. I mean, all this stuff was wrong. Let's get back to the 90% of people that were behind George Bush after 9/11. Let's get those people back, and let's get behind the right cause. Let's fight it again.
Right.
I think these letters that Michelle Bachmann and her four compatriots sent out back on June 13th to these inspectors general. You and I were talking about this during the break. They gave these inspectors general 90 days to respond, and that day runs out on September 13th. So I would encourage listeners to reach out to those congressmen and say, hey, if you don't hear from the IGs, what's the next step? We don't want this to die. We want to get to the bottom of this.
Right, absolutely. Well, something else that bears mentioning, we've got about 4 minutes left, is after listening to Janice Kepler and pointing out the 9/11courtcase.com and reading through those files, well, not only should we have went against Saudi Arabia, but Iran should have been first up because of, they trained in Iran.
That's right.
I don't see how we... Unless maybe Bush just had a grudge against Iraq because of Daddy, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I don't know that. So I find it very hard to believe that Saudi Arabia worked, the royal family worked actively with Iran. That just wouldn't happen. But what I do see is believable, and I read the case you're talking about, Havlish case. That is a compelling case, and the judge ruled in favor of the plaintiffs against Iran. It's a fascinating case. But all that to say, I think, Al-Qaeda decided to work with Hezbollah. Then you got Iran as an extension of Hezbollah working with Al-Qaeda. And I think there is absolutely some truth to that. But I think that was happening separate from what the Saudi royal family was behind.
Yeah, I agree. We had several things going on there at once.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. Wow. So I wonder if they're going to... never mind. So let's go with this. Tell us a little more about your book. You got about 2 minutes, and why don't you plug this book some more?
Yeah, Unsung Davids is a book that I started writing back in 2010. Being in the radio business, I interviewed a lot of interesting people, and there was a common theme through a lot of the guests that I spoke to, and they when they fought, they decided that they were faced with a battle against an ominous, wicked, or otherwise, unflattering foe, and they decided to fight instead of what so many of us do, is take the path of least resistance, because you get up against these opponents sometimes, whether it's a bureaucracy or a powerful politician or somebody that's got a lot more money or whatever, you go up against power. The inclination, human nature, is to back away and take the path of least resistance. This book is about 10 men who decided they weren't going to do that. And in fact, if they were so effective, and some of them won, I guess you could say some of them won, some of them had moral victories, some are still fighting, some dealt, you know, if you saw the movie 300, some made the king bleed, you know, the god king bleed, all that stuff. But at the root of it is, these people fought, they weakened Goliath. They weakened an ominous opponent. And the guys that could have come back to their side and delivered the final blow, the guys with power, stood on the sidelines. That was one of the things that I got out of this, is that these guys really were effective. I mean, they think about Rocky, you know, the movie Rocky.
Yeah.
He was just nailing Apollo Creed and all this. Well, you know, you had at some point you had these guys on the ropes, you know, these opponents on the ropes, and all it would have taken was for good men to come to their aid and finish off these guys, and they didn't do it. That's the sad thing, but the positive thing is the spirit in these 10 guys.
All right. Well, amen. Folks, you can pick up the book at Ben's website. Where's that website at again?
BenBarrack.com. And remember, it's Barrack, it's not Barack.
Barack, folks, it's Barack. Don't let him fool you. Hey, tune in and listen to his radio program. You should do that, too. And you don't, gee, hang up there. While I'm saying goodbye to you, I'm going to say goodbye to the people. I'm going to talk to you afterwards.
Okay.
Anyway, folks, pray about supporting the Mission Church and always, always, always be a blessing to others. We must remember that there's only one God, and He is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. His Son is Yeshua HaMashiach, who gave His life for our repented sins. He rose after 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth, and through Him is the only way to the Father. Remember to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, and all your soul. Then love thy neighbor as thyself. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. That's like praying for Messiah's return. Lord our God, Father Yahweh, King Universe, I ask in Yeshua HaMashiach's name that the Father blesses and keeps you, and His face shines upon you, and is gracious to you, and gives you peace like no one else or anything else can. Until next time, this is Pastor Dan saying goodbye and shalom.
You've just heard the Messiah's Branch broadcast featuring Pastor Dan. To contact Dan on the internet, go to messiahsbranch.org. To write to Dan, send a note to Messiah's Branch, 230 West 4th Street, Florence, Kansas, 66851. Tune in next time for Messiah's Branch.